Thank you very much for all the panelists and Mr. President to your input on this very topic. And of course, we can discuss this topic from different angles. Coming from the UN, I just would like to add two ideas to all the reflections we heard. Nowadays, we talk very often about a question whether the UN is a real reflection of the world or not. We see how the Security Council works or cannot work. And actually, I really believe that the UN deals with peace and security, human rights and development, and actually is a reflection of the world. Because if the world cannot agree, if the world cannot solve a problem, we can see it at the UN in every day. And that is why I would like to say that I very much believe in the preventive diplomacy. We are spending a lot of money within the UN system on peace building, on reconciliation, on peacekeeping operations, but we are not spending really money on preventive diplomacy. When we start to spend money and when we start to deal with problem, it is already in the late phase of this very problem, and we are very strongly advocating within the UN system the importance of the preventive diplomacy. Also, we talk about the importance of political will. You have to understand when we talk about the working methods, let's say, of the Security Council, where we can never forget what happened in Srebrenica, where we never can forget what happened in Rwanda, and we cannot forget what had and what is happening in Syria. We always have to remember that the Security Council first and the members of the Security Council first have to agree. That is why, for example, Hungary is very strongly advocating the so-called code of conduct. And I am happy to say that just before I left, more than 100 countries already supported the idea that no one sitting in a Security Council could veto anything which is related to mass destruction, to genocide of the people. We are actually talking here about basic political problems. We think it's natural, but actually it's not, because the Security Council is dealing with political interest, with power, and very often we are talking about these interests only and forgetting about the influence of science diplomacy, the influence of the so-called soft diplomacy, and the influence of what a World Science Forum like that can contribute to this very topic. Before I would like to open the floor, I would like to raise one question, and I would like really ask all the panelists to answer that, because we are talking here about a conflict or a possible working relationship between different cultures, civilizations, religions. This is a question that we also have to face, and to the question we have to be able to give answers through education, through science. And I'm just wondering what would be the answer for that, let's say, at UNESCO. Madam Assistant Director General, here is the microphone.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for this question. And I think it's been also addressed by my colleague from FAO that I guess the complexity of the issue of migration has to be considered when discussing it. And I think, yes, in some areas, and we've also discussed this morning during the meeting of the steering committee now of the World Science Forum, that obviously migration can be a driver and an enabler. I mean, if we have a brain circulation, if we have young people going from one country to another cultural area, sort of to get more experiences, to exchange ideas, to learn other circumstances, obviously that's a driver. That's a driver of economy, it's a driver of innovation, and so probably, hopefully also, it is a driver of a peaceful living together. But then on the other hand, and I think the colleague from FAO mentioned that obviously forced migration, when you're forced to migrate, not because you want to, or because you see a chance or an opportunity, but because you are living in an armed conflict, or you're thrown out of your area because of a natural disaster. I think this is a completely different issue. And I think it's also for UN agencies and also UNESCO quite a complex task to respond to these different levels of migration, because sometimes they're also interlinked. And they're not, and obviously they're not only interlinked in a positive sense, so, and also to respond to the diversity of challenges posed to our member states, also to address that diversity, and also now obviously with limited resources is quite a challenge, but obviously we're trying to face it and deliver on those issues.
Thank you very much. Would you like to continue this?
I would say, speaking from the vantage point of a country like mine and a region such as mine, where unfortunately the voice of civil society and academia still has a long way to go in order to impact decision makers and policy makers and governments in general, we are not the voice of hope that we should be. And so when you're in a state of hopelessness, such as that the migrants and refugees find themselves in, and want to look to people who ultimately should be talking about how to enable an investment in human dignity, an investment in improving the quality of people's lives through science, and they don't find that, then you've realized that there has to be something done about the STI infrastructure and environment that is lacking in our part of the world. We know that huge sums of money have been invested, maybe in bricks and mortar, unfortunately, but there has not been enough invested in terms of the public awareness. And you know, just a few hours ago, there was the session on galvanizing science education and research for fostering an innovation culture in the Arab region. President Novas, you mentioned about the concern that we would be perceived as being in something of an ivory tower. And I think in my part of the world, scientists are perceived as being too far removed from what is going on the ground. And I think it's for us to really buy the confidence of the people on the ground that science ultimately can provide solutions for prosperity, for a better standard of living.
Thank you very much. Professor Lovas, you have been working in the whole world, in the Americas, in Europe, now in Hungary. But what would be your answer to this? What is really the role of science in this situation like that?
I think that science has several roles in this kind of situations. First of all, data have to be analyzed, collected, and correctly interpreted. And as we have seen from the report of General Secretary Turok, this is often not an easy task, but it has to be done. Maybe I can add that science has been often used to build bridges between different nations, and diplomacy through sports and diplomacy through science are existing things. And so I think that connections between scientists could contribute to eventually finish or prevent these kind of extreme conflicts, which are causing then all the migration and all the other human tragedies that we are witnessing.
Thank you very much. I just would like to go back to the importance of the data. You may know or you may don't know that, again, on a Hungarian initiative, we decided creating the World Statistics Day, and we say better data, better life, because without that, we could not really analyze or even to fulfill the tasks we are facing and this, of course the Sustainable Development Goals. But I would like to go back to the FAO. I mean, this is a big question. Have you noticed about the real problems going on in the refugee camps and so on? We have heard and read about that. But, you know, what is your kind of knowledge? What is your kind of roots you are being in contact with the people staying in the refugee camps, having shortage of food and so on?
Of course, life in the refugee camps is very difficult, and it's quite obvious that people do not want to be there. And they want to have more comfortable environment, they want to have access to education, they want to have access to work. They don't have it in refugee camps. It's just you don't need to be a UN agency in order to understand that. So it's very important to try to provide to the people in these camps with some decent conditions, but of course the only option is just for them to get back to comfortable conditions. Where these conditions will be, it depends on all of us. And when we're talking about crisis, of course, preventive diplomacy is absolutely essential. We need probably stronger leadership in the United Nations in order to do that. I spent 28 years in diplomacy before starting to work for international organizations, and I know how difficult it is. But I also stay positive because I was a part of the very successful resolution settlement, crisis settlement in Cambodia, when people came from killing each other to peaceful country and very prosperous country. We can do it. We can do it. And talking about a very important issue, it's not because I'm FAO, it's just my personal experience in this life about integration of migrants, about the unity of our society. When the migrants were going to the United States, it was the state built on the idea they can incorporate their ethnicity into this state. When we talk about Europe, it's much more complicated, because all European countries and Middle Eastern countries and other countries, they have older countries, I would say, they have a very strong national identity. And we as a mankind, we want to preserve this national identity. How do we incorporate the newcomers? To my mind, actually, the attitude may be just the basic human rights. If the people come to the country, they should have an access to these basic human rights. I don't know, some countries, I worked in Ireland, they have UN Declaration of Human Rights in their constitution. In other countries, it's not the case. But basic human rights should be provided for the people coming to the country. The policy on migration is dictated by the national states, their prerogative. It should be done by the national states. But the national states should also understand, for instance, let's take the European Union project. It's a great success. We are talking a lot about doom and gloom about European Union, but we were capable of bringing all the countries of Europe together, keeping their identity. It was step-by-step approach. So in national policies, that can also be an attitude. And to my mind, that's... And another point, you mentioned here, Ambassador, just that the people would like to get back home. I believe it's absolutely the majority would like to have it. But before they can get back home, before the conflict is over, probably we should think about just some legal arrangements for them to be in the country. And it's up to the national governments to decide. I don't want to say that it's a solution, but probably Americans are now debating the issues of migration. We're here. Probably there should be larger legal field for the migrants, for the visas or whatever. I'm not an expert here, but that's also an option. For them to stay legally in the countries until the situation improves in their homelands. Thank you very much.
Professor, would you like to comment?
I have just one short comment coming back to your original question. I deeply believe in the cross-fertilization of cultures. And if we look at some successful European societies or countries, we find a bunch of examples, Spain, England, Italy, Hungary, Russia. I think this is a very important long-term approach which we should use a little bit more than we have done so far. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And now I would like to give the floor. We have 6 minutes for that. So the gentleman there, where is the microphone? Somewhere? Okay. Thank you very much. Would you like to introduce yourself? Thank you.
Yes, Michi Tetalovic. I'm a science journalist working in the UK. I'm originally from Croatia, and I hope that I have something to add to the intellectual life of the UK, unlike most of the Balkan people in Hungary, according to Professor Torok's presentation. I have two quick questions. One is for the Princess of Jordan, whom I had an opportunity to interview here in 2011. Do you think that all these migrations to your country made your country better or worse, so richer or poorer? And have you ever considered building a fence around your country to ban migrants coming in? And the second question is rather a comment about Professor Torek's presentation, as I found it quite shocking and pretty offensive, being from the Balkans, to suggest that the entire immigrants from Balkans add nothing to the intellectual life of Hungary, as if that's the only thing to measure immigrants by. And I found it really sort of scientific. It's not scientific, but it's like scientism. It's like you're just counting people and telling us their age without trying to interview those people and ask them about things. And I think this approach of science to migrants is probably not helpful, and I think society can probably do without it, if that's how we're going to do it. Because I think it does, as Princess of Jordan said, that scientists need to be rational but also humane. To me, this sounded rational, but didn't sound very humane. So I think we should keep that in mind when we're talking about science's role in looking into migration and what we do about it, because I guess it should help us with dealing with migration crisis, but not reinforcing stereotypes. Anyway, those are my comments and questions for the Princess. Thank you.
Princess?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's good to see you again. And as far as my country's concerned and my role in it, I describe myself as an NGO, which is a non-governmental organism. So my question, my reply to your question is totally my personal point of view. Yes, of course there would be times where one would wish that the Jordanian population can come first, because when I look at hospital beds and hospitals that are overflowing and no rooms for Jordanians, and the same with schools, of course it becomes an issue. But to be able to put a fence around my country is something within the geopolitical situation that Jordan has found herself in for so many years is an impossibility. It has always been the policy of Jordan to maintain an open door policy for all our neighbors. And I think it is impossible for us to now reverse that. The issue is, how do we make the best of accommodating these people who are in our country for the time being? I'm sure you know as a journalist that Zaatari refugee camp is now the third largest city in Jordan. And as I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, that the population today should be a comfortable 6 million. Today, it is almost double that. Our infrastructure can't cope. Just the village that I live in, we don't have enough electricity, enough water, and so on and so forth. So what to do? Yes, we need the support of the international community more and more often than not on the issues that are just highlighted in terms of dollar figures, but where can we help? And then I mentioned the issue of the social scientists, the impacts, the domino effect in terms of the psychological support, the role that needs to be given in terms of addressing mental issues that have now come and really penetrated the fabric of our society, Jordanians alike. I have a daughter who's at school, and she's somebody who now has to rub shoulders with people who have seen their families blown apart as a result of conflict, and is now preparing to leave to go to university, and wonders what the country she will come home to will be like. Will Jordan, the Jordan we know, the Jordanians we know, still be the Jordanians that she left behind? Because accents, dialects, all sorts of things are taking place in our country which are not part of the Jordanian fabric or matrix. And so, yes, it's a difficult situation. Of course, many Jordanians do call for closing the borders. But at the same time, I think it's been the vision and the leadership of Jordan that has always tried to maintain Jordan being a safe zone, with the hope of resolving the peace issue, not just today with Iraq and Syria, but of course the Palestinian question as well, which would mean that people would have the right to return. And so I think you just have to keep looking for that light at the end of the tunnel and hoping that eventually they will one day return and we will find eternal peace and stability for my region and country. Thank you.
Professor?
Well, I must tell you that I deeply believe in statistics. Unfortunately, we did not have enough time to show you all the statistical data that we have produced. Regarding the Balkans, this is a summary name for the countries there. If we could show you the detailed data, it would have turned out that the Balkan countries meant in the first place Kosovo, Montenegro, and a little bit Macedonia. There was no immigration from Croatia in the data that we have analyzed. Second, we based our analysis of success of integration or failure of integration on employment statistics in the first place, and we could show that unfortunately people coming from Kosovo, Montenegro and Albania were unemployed much more or much more often than those coming from Asia and from the Middle East. This is what is described in the paper or the study and nothing else. Thank you very much.
One more question, because then we are continuing somewhere else. There was the gentleman at the back. I saw your hand beforehand. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen. My name is Mihai Schwantner, and I represent the World Intellectual Property Organization, another UN sister agency from Geneva. And I just want to flag one issue, that when we observe the development of the science and invention, we observe in the past decade, at least very clearly, that the geographical move is becoming very obvious, that the number of patents and inventions are moving from the traditional states and countries to new areas, including such as China, India, and so on. In the same time, I think that we are observing also in the inventions and sciences another evolution, in particular in the IT fields, that the young scientists are playing more and more important role in the defining of the direction of the development of sciences. In this connection, I just want to flag one duty, which I'm not happy quite clearly so far, that we in the UN, we should organize, we should put much more projects, cross-cultural projects for young scientists, to involve them, to give them responsibilities, to give them a visible role in an international, intergeographical sort of logic. And I think that that will have a tremendous impact also in the solutions that we are looking forward for the refugee influx, for the crisis, be it natural disaster or civil conflicts and so on. So I trust very much that the need in the UN family for providing this new type of projects for young scientists, young researchers, should be taken somehow seriously in the future, and I think that we will be able to mark points. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Here I would like to thank all the panelists contributing in this panel. And thank you very much, Professor Lovas, organizing and initiating this meeting. And I just, as kind ofwrapping up of all this problematic, I would like to go back to the Sustainable Development Goals, in which we all the leaders of the whole world agreed. And within that, I think we made it very clear that the international community must rely heavily on all forms of scientific cooperation to bring Sustainable Development Goals about, as science, technology, and innovation have played a critical role in making significant strides towards meeting the Millennium Development Goals. Science, technology, and innovation will remain a crucial and overall enabler and equalizer in the context of the new 2013 agenda, a driver for all the 17 sustainable development goals. And yes, we are struggling, but I just would like to remind us all what Martin Luther King Jr. said: the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.